From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Just a couple of weeks ago, during the holidays, people were celebrating, but immigration agents were getting ready for raids.
It really affects the psyche and sort of overall well-being of people who are potentially affected by these raids.
Those affected most were Central American women and children seeking asylum. But what sent them fleeing here in the first place?
145 of 322 live in a neighborhood with a gang present, and 14 have had at least one of their family members murdered by the gangs.
And what the U.S. government is doing in Central America to stem the flow of migrants.
These countries suffer from severe corruption, government agencies that don't function well, police that don't do police work.
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. How about if you take a listen to Microphone Check? It's the hip-hop podcast from NPR. Hosts Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly talk to the biggest names and the best-kept secrets in hip-hop, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers, and artists like Pusha T and Masta Ace. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This past Christmas, while most everyone was celebrating, the Obama administration announced it would begin deportation raids on Central American migrants.
Plans to round up and deport hundreds of families who crossed the border.
And sure enough, during New Year's weekend, more than 100 people were apprehended by immigration agents. Officials knocked on their doors, put them in detention, and ultimately sent them out of the country. Most of those deported that weekend had come to the United States in 2014. They were mostly women with children and kids who had come alone from Central America seeking asylum in the United States. You might remember that back then, the White House called this influx a humanitarian crisis.
An urgent humanitarian situation that needs to be dealt with. And you've seen a very...
Now, more than a year later, we aren't hearing as much about this anymore. But one crisis that has been making regular headlines is the Syrian refugee crisis. Every month, about 70,000 Syrian refugees are fleeing a deadly civil war. And there's been a lot of debate over how the U.S. should respond and how many Syrian refugees the U.S. should take in. Meanwhile, much closer to home, thousands of migrants continue to leave Central America every day, fleeing violence, political unrest, corruption, and deep poverty. Honduras was the murder capital of the world for many years. And last year, El Salvador reached the highest death toll since its own civil war took place in the 1980s. So on today's show, we ask, what is happening now in Central America? And how is the U.S. handling Central American migrants seeking asylum? To begin answering some of these questions, our producer, Fernanda Chavarri, joins me now in the studio. So, Fernanda, let's start with what we know about those raids that were going on the very first weekend of this year.
Well, what we know is that 121 people, that's Central American adults and children, were taken into custody, primarily in Georgia, Texas, and North Carolina, and they were put on flights and deported. The Department of Homeland Security said that those people had been caught at the U.S.-Mexico border during what you remember as the 2014 influx of migrants and had lost their cases in immigration court. Now, there are hundreds of people who get deported every day, but what made this deportation different is that these were specifically targeted families that had come here seeking asylum.
All right, so that influx that you just mentioned, that was more than 120,000 people showing up at the border and asking for asylum. And the idea that the government is actively going after those families now, these are people who are scared, And now they're being targeted.
And that's what I heard from Rebecca Press. She's an attorney representing immigrant youth for the Legal Aid Society in New York. Some of her clients are from Central America seeking asylum here.
They've heard ICE is around, through word of mouth, ICE is here, ICE is there.
And it's worth mentioning that after these Central Americans were apprehended at the border, most of them were placed in temporary shelters or with family members, so they've been living here since then.
It really affects the psyche and sort of overall well-being of people who are potentially affected by these raids.
So two things are happening. Some people are not showing up to their immigration court appointments out of fear that they'll be taken into custody, and others are doing the opposite.
In fact, we've seen people who realize that they have orders of removal already coming out of the woodwork and saying, hey, wait a minute, I want to try to fix this situation because I'm so terrified that ICE will remove me.
And we have the Department of Homeland Security right now essentially saying the raids are going to continue. They're not going to stop.
Yet at the same time, we're going to continue to admit refugees in the United States from these countries. Secretary of State John Kerry said that the U.S. is going to increase the number of refugees admitted. That's both from the Syrian refugee crisis, but also specifically directed at people from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And right now, we have a cap of 3,000 people that can be admitted from those countries.
So the United States is continuing the raids, but they're also saying that they acknowledge that the situation in Central America is so bad that people might have legitimate refugee claims.
This brings up a good question of why some people seeking asylum get the refugee status and some don't. The international definition of what makes a refugee is somebody who can prove that they are being persecuted because of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or for being part of a particular group of people. Celina de Sola lives in El Salvador and runs an organization called Glasswing International that works with kids living in dangerous areas in Central America.
We have kids that on a daily basis hear gunshots. And, you know, a lot of the kids we work with have had a family member that's been shot or killed, or they've experienced violence directly.
And of course, those who are leaving, they have to make it through a long and difficult journey across Mexico, which is pretty dangerous on its own. And in the last year, Mexico has actually deported a large number of Central American migrants.
You know, the people that we see that have come back are exhausted, and either they're afraid to go home or they really, really want to try again.
So basically, whether it's Mexico or the U.S. deporting Central Americans, if the situation where these people are living is dangerous and if they have so few opportunities to make a real life for themselves, they will keep trying to leave.
And you know what, Fernanda, I have to say, the more I hear about this, the more I'm reminded about the tens of thousands of Central American refugees that were fleeing the civil wars in the 1980s. Back then, one thing that was happening was that churches were actually opening their doors in order to provide some sort of protection to the refugees.
And actually, the church where the sanctuary movement began in the 1980s that you're talking about is sort of reviving those efforts and has been doing that in recent years. That's the Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. It has given sanctuary to two people facing deportation recently. And Allison Harrington, the pastor there, says that since the raids on New Year's, there has been a growing conversation among religious leaders about what they should be doing.
And we do talk details. We talk not only the theological framework in which we're dealing with, but we talk about the really practical things about what is the liturgy, what are the prayers that you're using when you welcome somebody in? How do you deal with church insurance when maybe the church insurance policy is saying, no, you can't have someone living in sanctuary?
There's different congregations in Oregon, California, parts of Texas, and Minnesota that are actually starting to install showers and kitchens in their facilities to be able to give sanctuary if needed.
A variety of people all across the nation are saying, we cannot allow our government to deport mothers and children back to what we know is horrific violence. And we're going to do whatever it takes to keep them safe.
So I should point out that the reason why some people are going into sanctuary at these churches is because immigration enforcement has said that they're not going to actively seek people who are in churches or schools unless they are an immediate threat to Homeland Security.
Right. But back to the 1980s, there was a federal lawsuit against the churches, against the sanctuary movement. So who knows where we go from here? Thanks a lot, Fernanda, for joining us and for doing this reporting.
Thank you, Maria.
As we just heard, religious leaders all over the country are beginning to address this issue of Central American refugees. But what's being talked about in terms of political leaders? I sat down with our digital director and political junkie, Julio Ricardo Varela, to talk about that. So let's start with the Democrats, Julio. What is Hillary Clinton saying right now about this situation?
Well, just recently in Iowa with Jorge Ramos, Hillary Clinton finally went on record to talk about this. And she said something to the effect that she was against deportation raids. But I can't say a blanket statement to Jorge Ramos that no deportation of children of Central America.
Can you promise that you won't deport children? And can you promise that you won't deport immigrants who don't have a criminal record?
Here's what I can promise, Jorge. I can promise that I will do everything possible to provide due process. We have to change the immigration, asylum, and refugee laws.
Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley, which one of them is furthest to the left, or are they both in the same camp?
Basically, both O'Malley and Sanders are way to the left of Clinton, and Clinton has sort of taken a more moderate approach. Martin O'Malley in Iowa earlier in January got really, really emotional about this topic.
What the hell have we come to as a country that you're talking about rounding up women and children fleeing death gangs at Christmas time? Mary and Joseph and Jesus had to flee death gangs at Christmas time. So I'm opposed to that.
For him, it's not translating to votes with young Latinos. But as for Sanders, that's where it gets interesting. Senator Sanders is basically saying no deportation raids and everyone gets to stay. He wrote a letter to President Obama at the beginning of January, and he actually tweeted as well. I urge at POTUS, POTUS is the Twitter handle, to immediately cease the deportation raids and not deport families back to countries where a death sentence awaits. So it's very clear language from Senator Sanders.
Right, Julio, let's move into a conversation about the Republicans. Ted Cruz, what has he been saying about this issue?
It's really interesting that the ad that he comes out about immigration.
And I will say the politics of it would be very, very different if a bunch of lawyers or bankers were crossing the Rio Grande. Or if a bunch of people with journalism degrees were coming over and driving down the wages in the press. Then we would see stories about the economic calamity that is befalling our nation.
Fascinating ad. Basically, it's people looking like they're crossing the Rio Grande, but they're wearing high heels, power suits, briefcases, and carrying their iPhones. Very dramatic.
It's such a contrast from Democrats actually talking about people from Central America.
But let me ask you about Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush. Anything that they have said, anything around this issue?
They haven't been that vocal, although Rubio says, you know, he's talking about cutting off funding for sanctuary cities.
So I do not support amnesty, and I never have. I've always believed there has to be real consequences for violating our immigration laws. When I'm president, there will not be amnesty. Criminal aliens will be immediately deported. And, for example, sanctuary cities are going to lose their federal funding. I believe there needs to be real and significant consequences to violating our immigration laws, and that should be triggered and linked to security, securing our border.
The fact that this is a national security issue, so this image of the fleeing Central American migrant going up north is somehow tied to ISIS. Obviously, Trump has taken that to the extreme. Ted Cruz is following that language. Even a Marco Rubio. That's the narrative that's being told.
Digital director Julio Ricardo Varela, who works at Latino USA and Futuro Media. Coming up on Latino USA, the story behind Central America's gangs, as told by one former member.
This group provided some of my needs that I had, you know, the sense of belonging, the sense of protection, the sense of being taken into account.
Stay with us. No te vayas. Hi, how you doing? So before we get back to our show, I want to make sure that you know just how much your donations mean to our organization. Your support allows us to keep doing what we love to do, which is independent journalism. And the comments that you send to us with your contributions, well, they really do inspire us. Here's a note from a new monthly sustainer, Lindsay from Astoria, Queens, who tells us, I especially appreciate the many episodes that explore identity and the role of place and culture in shaping how we view ourselves. Thank you again for the great work of Latino USA. So please, if you can, join Lindsay and so many other amazing listeners who have gone to latinousa.org and clicked on the donate button. Every single contribution helps. Muchas gracias. And before we get back to the show, it would be really great if you could take a moment to rate and review Latino USA on iTunes. Those of you who have already done so, yes, thank you. It helped us find new listeners. And your comments, by the way, we read them out loud in our office. So keep them coming. Muchas gracias, everyone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're bringing you an update about what's happening with the wave of Central American migrants to the United States that intensified beginning in 2014. Now, in order to understand why so many people have been coming to the United States, you have to understand a little bit more about the long and very complicated relationship between the United States and Central America. We're going to start our history lesson in the 1980s. If you were growing up in the 1980s, what you remember is headline after headline about Central America as a region that was destabilized and racked with violence. In El Salvador, a group of guerrillas known as the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, or the FMLN, were fighting against a military government in a civil war that lasted more than a decade. The conflict displaced hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans and claimed 80,000 lives. In Guatemala, meanwhile, a civil war between leftist groups and the Guatemalan military lasted for 36 years, and almost 200,000 people were either killed or disappeared. And to the south in Nicaragua, there were right-wing counter-revolutionaries known as the Contras who were fighting against the Sandinista socialist government. Now, internationally, these very specific Central American conflicts were relevant to the broader Cold War. And the U.S. feared that these Central American countries would fall under the influence of communism as part of the domino theory. And so the United States decided to intervene.
A number of times in past years, members of Congress and a president have come together in meetings like this to resolve a crisis. I have asked for this meeting in the hope that we can prevent one.
Under President Ronald Reagan, the U.S. pumped millions of dollars into the authoritarian Salvadoran and Guatemalan governments and to their militaries.
Central America's problems do directly affect the security and the well-being of our own people. And Central America is much closer to the United States than many of the world trouble spots that concern us.
U.S. taxpayers paid for military aid and training camps for troops, many of which were located in Honduras. But at that time, Honduras wasn't going through a war. The United States, though, began to use it as a kind of home base for all of the military activity that it was doing in Central America. And all of this set off a wave of refugees that fled from Guatemala and El Salvador to the United States.
The reason why people came to the United States during the 1980s in particular was because of the wide destabilization that the United States was very intimately involved with.
That's Cesar Cuauhtemoc García Hernández, who is a professor at the University of Denver and who studies the intersections of criminal and immigration law. He says the U.S. government assumed that many of the refugees were ideologically aligned with the communist guerrillas.
And so when Salvadoreños arrived in the United States and sought political asylum, the position of the Reagan administration was to view those claims very suspiciously.
By the end of the 1980s, up to 1 million Salvadorans had migrated to the United States. But only a quarter of them were able to get legal status. Tens of thousands, meanwhile, were arriving from Guatemala as asylum seekers. And according to Professor Garcia, the migrants who are arriving today might not be escaping a civil war, but they are escaping the damage that those wars left behind.
Political destabilization and economic strife are not problems that are resolved from one day to another. So we are still living with the consequences of the political unrest that affected Central America in the 1980s.
Now, there's actually pretty good data as to why the recent wave of migrants are leaving Central America, thanks to people like Elizabeth Kennedy.
At this point, I've done just over 600 interviews.
Kennedy is a social scientist at San Diego State University, and she researches El Salvador. In 2014, she interviewed Central American kids who were either planning to migrate or who had recently returned home after a failed attempt to get to the United States. The most common answer as to why they were leaving was
gangs, violence, and insecurity. That's listed by 60%. As far as what that looks like in their daily lives, 145 of 322 live in a neighborhood with a gang present, and 14 have had at least one of their family members murdered by the gangs. Finally, there are 32 of these children who are so afraid that they never leave their homes at day or night.
The gangs that kept these children trapped in their houses are called the Mara Salvatrucha, which is also known as MS-13, and their rivals, which are the 18th Street Gang, which is Barrio 18. The violence generated by their fighting has become one of the biggest challenges facing El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras today. And those gangs were born and bred right here in the United States. Our producer Marlon Bishop has been digging into this issue.
If you've heard anything about the Mara Salvatrucha, it probably went something like this.
It's the most violent gang in America. It has 10,000 foot soldiers in the U.S., spreading its brutal ways across 33 states.
The crimes were the handiwork of one of the deadliest gangs in the world, Mara Salvatrucha, known as MS-13.
MS is spreading fast, like a virus, and mutating into an international menace.
These clips from TV documentaries may be sensationalist, but you get the gist. Mara Salvatrucha, better known as MS-13, has earned a reputation as one of the most violent gangs anywhere, with possibly up to 100,000 members in the U.S., Mexico, and Central America. But long before MS-13 was an international super gang, it began as a group of young immigrants in Los Angeles, California, made up of guys like Alex.
My name is Alex Sanchez. I'm an immigrant from El Salvador. I came here as a child in 1979, just before the war started. I got in trouble with my issues of the clash of culture I was confronted with, and I ultimately joined a gang.
That gang was MS-13. Alex has since left and now leads a nonprofit called Homies Unidos, which means Homies United. They help rehabilitate former gang members. Few people managed to get out of MS-13 as Alex did, but the way he got in is typical. His parents immigrated to the U.S. in the mid-70s. They left Alex and his little brother with relatives in El Salvador when they were very young. A smuggler was hired later to bring the kids to California. Alex was 7 years old and only knew his mother from a black and white photo he carried with him on the journey.
We were traded in downtown L.A. with our parents. The Coyotes gave us and to our parents, and our parents gave the money. So we're sitting in the truck with my brother and looking at these two complete strangers that we had to call mom and dad. So it was really difficult, the transition of the separation of my parents was really difficult to kind of mend. And in some ways, we never did.
Alex's family lived near the Pico Union neighborhood, where most Salvadoran immigrants in the city settled. They struggled to adapt to their new lives.
the most difficult thing was transitioning into the mainstream culture, which was predominantly Mexican or Chicano, and we suffered a lot of persecution because of our differences in the way we spoke Spanish, the fact that we were immigrants from Central America, and we suffered a lot of bullying in school, in the community.
Soon, Alex started spending time with a group of Salvadoran kids that weren't ashamed to be from Central America, kids who stood up to the bullying. They were members of MS-13, a new gang formed in imitation of the Mexican and African American gang that had long been a fixture in L.A.
It didn't take too long for me to actually really start liking the fact that this group provided some of my needs that I had, you know, the sense of belonging, the sense of protection, the sense of being taken into account.
Alex was jumped into the gang at age 14 and soon left home to live with members of his new so-called family. He started drinking, doing drugs, and eventually committing crimes.
You know, eventually you get arrested for one of those things, either stealing or assaults and whatnot. And I ended up getting arrested for assaults, and I ended up in juvenile hall.
Time spent at juvenile hall only hardened Alex's instincts and led him on the path to prison. Then, in 1994, Alex was deported back to El Salvador. He wasn't alone. In the early 90s, the LAPD began collaborating with the Immigration and Naturalization Service to deport immigrants convicted of aggravated felonies. A 1996 federal law made it even easier for judges to deport gang members. This law especially affected MS-13, since so many members were undocumented. Between 2000 and 2004 alone, an estimated 20,000 Central American criminals were deported back to their home countries. Here's law professor Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, who follows the issue.
Once back in Central American countries that were only barely beginning to move beyond civil war, there was almost no ability for those countries to absorb these young people back into their society in any productive fashion. And so eventually those gangs became much larger, much more powerful.
Alex Sanchez says he had hoped that going back to El Salvador would be a fresh start, a chance to leave the gang life.
But all of that went out the window as soon as I got out of the airport. As I was going towards a terminal, I saw a boulder out of a hillside with the letters of the MS-13. As we kept on that road, there was a big wall, and it had the Roman numerals, XV111. And that's when I realized that the rivals were there, too.
XV111 was the symbol for the 18th Street Gang, MS-13's sworn enemy from Los Angeles. Through the mass deportations, both gangs gained a presence in Central America. Their turf wars came with them. By the early 2000s in El Salvador, the growing gang menace became a hot political issue. The government started a get-tough-on-crime policy called the mano dura, or tough hand.
The effects of these policies have been very, very, very bad.
Jose Miguel Cruz is an expert on Salvadoran gangs at Florida International University. He says the basic principle of mano dura was to get gang members off the street and into prisons. It was inspired by the zero-tolerance policing model that was used in New York, but taken further. The government passed an anti-gang law that allowed police to arrest people who simply appeared to belong to a gang, whether or not they committed a crime based on tattoos or style of dress.
They just locked them up and left them there. Being there 24/7 without any supervision, without any program inside the prisons, gang members basically have all the time to organize, to generate some sort of structures and leadership that allow them to grow as a criminal organization, something that they weren't at the beginning.
The plan backfired. Swollen with criminals, the prisons became finishing schools for gang members. Jose says that if the U.S. policy of deportation gave gangs a toehold in Central America, mano dura made them thrive. Just look at the numbers.
Before the mano dura, gangs were responsible more or less of 7% of all homicides in El Salvador. After the mano dura, gangs were responsible almost 45% of homicides in El Salvador.
Meanwhile, the government gave tacit approval to armed vigilante groups. The most notorious of these was La Sombra Negra, the Black Shadow, whose death squads executed people they suspected of gang membership. Honduras and Guatemala started mano dura-style programs of their own, with similar results. Estimates of gang membership today are up to 40,000 in Honduras and 30,000 in El Salvador. Murder rates in all three countries are among the world's highest. A 2010 UN report declared that the mano dura approach was a failure, that it was good at winning votes, but only made the gang problem worse.
There has not been a sense of investment on our youth, but a sense of repression. It's not stopping the problem because they're not hitting the root cause of them.
Alex Sanchez says that mass poverty and the lack of opportunities for young people in El Salvador are the reasons why they get involved with gangs in the first place. While in El Salvador, he saw how joining a gang could make a poor street kid feel important. The attraction was obvious.
To see a 12-year-old kid who's been abused for so long, abandoned and mistreated, to all of a sudden, you know, just put on a tattoo and be empowered and feared the level these kids were feared was too empowering.
In the mid-90s, Alex decided to return to California. He says he had been targeted by the Sombra Negra death squads and needed to flee. Once back in the States, he made the decision to renounce his gang membership. He began the painful process of getting his tattoos removed and started doing gang intervention work. Now, when he sees the new groups of children from Central America arriving, he's reminded of his own story. Different era, but the same problems.
That's where it all starts. I mean, the fact that they're seeking refuge and they are giving refugees, that is here, does not mean that they're going to be happy and rejoice once they see their families. You know, these kids are going to be troubled. These kids are already at risk. You know, many of these kids are going to go live in poor areas where there's drug addiction, where there's violence, where there's crime, where there's inadequate housing, where there's gangs, you know, and these children could fall prey to any of those things.
It's the same story that Alex lived, a cycle of poverty, violence, migration, alienation, gang life, deportation, rinse and repeat. If nothing is done to intervene on behalf of these children, he says, that same cycle will continue and continue and continue.
And our producer, Marlon Bishop, who reported that piece, joins me now in the studio. Hey, Marlon.
Hey, how's it going?
So we've been hearing for many, many years now about, quote unquote, out of control growth of gangs in Central America. Is it, in fact, out of control? And what's shifted in terms of gangs in each of these Central American countries?
Well, in El Salvador, things are definitely getting quite a bit worse. The murder rate has almost doubled from 69 per 100,000 people in 2014, which was already one of the highest in the world, to 103, making it by far the highest in the world right now. Meanwhile, in Honduras and Guatemala, murder rates have actually gotten a little bit better.
Any sense about why those numbers took a bit of a dip?
Well, that's where things get a little controversial because of politics. Those countries have been dominated over the last couple of years by right-wing governments with a platform that often centered around cracking down on crimes. And they had a very militaristic response to the gang problem. And that seems to have had some results. But at the same time, the original mano dura approach that we saw during the early 2000s is widely seen to have backfired because this military repression ended up being more like a band-aid to kind of cover it for the moment. So it's hard to tell whether these reductions in those countries are kind of going to last and what the long-term consequences are going to be.
Any sense about what happened in El Salvador that it would take this turn for the worse?
Well, one of the main reasons that most people can agree on is that there was a gang truce between the Mara Salvatrucha and Barrio 18, who are, you know, the two biggest gangs, and that truce fell apart in 2014. Another element is that Barrio 18 in El Salvador has kind of ruptured and split into two, and those two sides have kind of generated more violence.
What's your sense of what the future of El Salvador looks like right now?
So I spoke with Elizabeth Kennedy, who is the researcher we heard from earlier, and she says that she anticipates more and more migrants are going to be coming because things in El Salvador don't look like they're getting better anytime soon.
Coming up on Latino USA, why are people in Honduras begging the U.S. government not to send money?
Se roban ese dinero.
They're robbing this money. We went to Washington, D.C. to tell Congress that they have to make sure that this money is controlled. They need to know that they are wasting, or they're going to waste, a lot of money if they don't put more limitations on it.
Stay tuned. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. How about if you take a listen to Microphone Check? It's the hip-hop podcast from NPR. Hosts Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly talk to the biggest names and the best-kept secrets in hip-hop, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers, and artists like Pusha T and Masta Ace. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives now and for generations to come, on the web at rwjf.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So far on our episode, we've heard about recent deportations of Central American migrants seeking asylum, and we've also heard about some of the root causes. Why are people leaving their homes? But now we want to turn to what the U.S. government is doing in Central America right now.
Of course, if there's one thing this new century has taught us, is that we cannot separate our work here at home from challenges beyond our shores.
That's President Barack Obama last year asking Congress for $1 billion in aid for Central America. That's billion with a B. Congress approved $750 million, but they haven't disbursed it yet. Joining me now in the studio is our producer, Sarah Barrett, who's been looking into Obama's plan for the region. So to start off with, Sarah, what's the context of this plan? And hasn't the United States really been pumping millions of dollars into this region for years now?
Absolutely. We've actually given $2.3 billion to Mexico in recent years, and that was all to beef up their immigration enforcement. The money seems to have had a very big impact. In 2015, the number of migrants that the U.S. apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border dropped by more than half. And at the same time, the number of migrants apprehended in Mexico ballooned by 70%.
So Mexico now has actually become a country that is receiving and deporting migrants in a way that never used to happen in the past.
Never used to happen in the past. The statistics have totally flipped. The criticism of this plan is that it's not solving the problem. All it's doing is moving the problem to Mexico. It's moving the border from between the U.S. and Mexico to Mexico and Guatemala.
So What's different about this plan?
You know, I was curious about that, too. And I spoke with Eric Olson, the associate director of the Latin America program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And this is what he said.
It's really trying to address the drivers of migration in Central America. And to me, that's a very positive sign, focusing on things like justice and good policing.
So how are they going to do that? Will the money that Obama has asked for, will it be going to specific programs like in microfinance or to build schools?
You know, we don't really know yet. They haven't actually announced where the money is going to be going. They have said that they want to focus on three specific things: on economic opportunity, on governance, and on security. Here's Olson again.
We all understand that these countries in the northern part of Central America suffer from severe problems of corruption, government agencies that don't function well, justice systems that don't mete out justice. And so this is designed to strengthen that capacity in governance that will help public trust in the government to actually protect them.
Isn't that really part of the main issue, though, that the governments aren't trusted to protect their people? They're so corrupt. And so the United States sending money into governments that are questionable, how is that going to fix the problem?
That's a major issue. We do have one good example of how things can get better. There is a UN-backed oversight committee in Guatemala, and it's been operating there since 2006. It has allowed prosecutors to actually convict corrupt officials. It even helped to bring down the president and vice president when they were caught in a corruption scandal last summer.
Does Obama's Central American strategy set up similar oversight committees like the one that exists in Guatemala?
Unfortunately, nothing is planned that is as powerful as the UN-backed committee that's happening in Guatemala. Obama's plan asks Central American governments to measure their progress against corruption, but there's no official oversight from the U.S. or the United Nations. Eric Olson says a lot of Central Americans want some kind of oversight.
The overwhelming sentiment I hear from people, average people, citizens in these countries is, you know, the U.S. has to stop just giving our governments money because there's a general sense that there's so much corruption that only the U.S. has real leverage with them.
So does Olson think that Obama's strategy will actually use that leverage to create some real change?
Again, right now it's hard to foresee. Congress has said that it will disburse half the money at first, and Central American countries are expected to prove that they're making progress. And only after that will Congress release the second half of the money.
Let's just remember we're talking about $750 million of taxpayer money. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Maria.
Now, over the last year, an anti-corruption protest movement has exploded in Central America. In Honduras, indignant protesters are filling the streets. In fact, the last time there were protests in Honduras was in 2009, and there was a coup then against President Manuel Zelaya that left a power vacuum and eroded much of the authority that the government did have. The next president in Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, promised to clean house, but now he's been accused of stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from the country's social security system. So out of all of this mess in Honduras came the country's first anti-corruption party. It's actually called the Partido Anticorrupción. The party's founder is Salvador Nasraya, and he's a former television personality. We spoke to him this week from his office in Tegucigalpa. Bienvenido a Latino USA. Welcome to Latino USA, Salvador Nasraya.
Muchas gracias. Un placer estar platicando con ustedes.
Why the need for a party dedicated to anti-corruption?
La anticorrupción.
I started the anti-corruption party here in Honduras because the traditional political class has robbed the resources of this rich country and made this country of 8 million people poor.
Los recursos de un país rico.
Give us an example of what corruption looks like for you, on a kind of daily, from a small example to a big example. ¿Nos podrías dar esos ejemplos, Salvador?
Mira,
look,
la policía,
the police and the population in general aren't receiving enough money for the work they're doing. It's not enough to buy food, transportation, and health care. When police ask for a bribe, it's corrupt, but really, they're just trying to bring home a little more money for their family so that they can eat. Here in Honduras, 2 million people only eat once a day.
En Honduras hay 2 millones de personas que solamente come una vez al día.
Salvador, members of your party, the Anti-Corruption Party, recently made a kind of unusual decision to travel to Washington, D.C. You came here to speak to members of the U.S. Congress to ask them to put limitations on a $750 million strategy by the Obama administration to combat corruption and violence in Central America. Why did you come to the United States? What were your demands?
Historically, when the U.S. and other countries give Honduras money, politicians don't use the money to fix quality of life in this country. Instead, they take it. They're robbing this money. We went to Washington, D.C. to tell Congress that they have to make sure that this money is controlled. They need to know that they are wasting a lot of money if they don't put more limitations on it.
What do you think is the best solution for taking corruption head-on in Honduras?
La solución para combatir la corrupción en Honduras es...
The solution for combating corruption in Honduras is that we elect a new government. And this new government put trustworthy leaders in power. What's happening right now? The president, alongside the thieves, are making sure that power stays in the control of the traditional political party and that the thieves will be protected by that party and the court they elect.
En el poder ejecutivo.
That was Salvador Nasralla. He's the leader of the Partido Anticorrupción, or the Anti-Corruption Party in Honduras. Moving now to Guatemala, where there have also been anti-corruption protests. Enough protest to actually bring down the president, Otto Pérez Molina, who is now in jail waiting trial on corruption charges. In the election that followed after President Otto Pérez Molina ended up in prison, a political outsider and TV comedian, Jimmy Morales, campaigned on the slogan, Ni corrupto, ni ladrón, which means not corrupt, not a thief. And he won by a landslide. A lot has changed politically in Guatemala, but actually little has changed day to day for most Guatemalans. Three quarters still live below the poverty line, and people still look to the United States as a place to escape to. Over the past couple of years, filmmaker Luis Argueta has been interviewing young Guatemalans deported from Mexico on their journey north, and he joins me now in the studio again. Luis Argueta, welcome back to Latino USA.
My pleasure to be here, Maria. Muchas gracias por la oportunidad.
So, on the ground in Guatemala, you basically, you're a filmmaker, you start talking to people. So give us a sense of, in general, what you are finding.
The first place we went to was a shelter for unaccompanied minors in Quetzaltenango. The one in Quetzaltenango receives the unaccompanied minors who are sent back, deported from Mexico.
And when you're in this shelter for children that have been sent back to Guatemala from Mexico, you meet a young woman named Isias.
Yes, she was 14 years old. I have to tell you, this was the second time she had been deported in 3 weeks.
Yo voy para ayudarles a mis padres.
I'm going to help my parents.
Porque mis padres están aquí y sufren
because
mucho.
My parents are here and they suffer a lot.
Deudas y todo. Tengo mi hermana allá, pero...
My sister is in the States, but she has her own kids and she needs to maintain them too.
Isias, she's not Guatemalan?
She is Guatemalan. We start to talk to her in Spanish.
But I notice a kind of Caribbean accent, maybe from Belize.
She was speaking Spanish, and all of a sudden, she said something like, you know, my Spanish is not so good. I said, what? Yeah, I speak English. I live in Belize. And then we started talking in English. And so she's talking about her aunt in Philadelphia.
My aunt helped me a lot. She paid that person to care me and all the stuff. Work is waiting for me there. And they were paying me like $100 a day. That's 700 quetzales here. Where will you win that here in a day? That I'm checking. That's why I'm going from here to have a better life. I was babysitting, but it's like, you see, $100 is 700 quetzales, right? And then I went here 600 a month quetzales. What's that? It's nothing.
So when you asked her, you know, point blank, look, did you know how dangerous this was? And she said, yes. What was your understanding of her notion of the danger?
One of the women who was with me asked her, do you know you could be raped? And her answer was, yes, indeed. The coyote already tried to rape me, but I defended myself. I know how to take care of myself.
Now, Isias is one of the young people who actually didn't make it to the U.S. border. She gets caught and sent back from Mexico. And you asked her about that.
What was the place like?
They do not treat people good like how they treat here, right? You have everything nice, clean, and there is just disgusting. Nothing clean there.
Where did you sleep there?
Well, they give you like a sponge, but the sponge is like the scent of it. It's like lone pee-pee and all those stuff. They do not wash the sheets. We suffer a lot.
You spoke with a father who was waiting for his child after the child had been deported back from Mexico.
Don Julio César, ¿y usted qué está haciendo aquí?
Esperando aún a mi hija.
I'm waiting for my daughter.
Que viene deportada de México.
She was deported from Mexico. She's 16 years old.
Tiene 16 años.
This man had come from far away to pick up his daughter. I said, don't you know that it's dangerous? And he said, yes, I do. And I told her that it was dangerous and please not to go. But she insisted and she left. And then I said, what will it take for kids like your daughter not to go? And he said, opportunities.
Ya no hay modos para poder salir adelante. Somos pobres.
There aren't ways for us to come out ahead. We are poor. We don't have money to put our kids through school or job opportunities.
What are you hearing on the ground? Are tougher border patrols and more deportations, are they actually a deterrent?
There is a woman that I talked to whose father is in Maryland. He paid about $6,000 to come a little bit over a year ago. She said to me, I want to go. He already paid his debt in 1 year. And the woman that's telling me this has two kids, 4 and 5 years old. And I say, we need to keep this woman in Guatemala. We need to give her a job. We need to give her education. We need to keep these kids fed, because otherwise she's going to come and leave those kids with the grandmother. And that's what we have to fight.
Luis Argueta, thank you so much for your on-the-ground reporting while you were in Guatemala.
My pleasure. Gracias, Maria.
Now, we usually close up our show with a little piece of wisdom, or sabiduría. This week, we want to send you off with the sabiduría, the wisdom that can only be found in numbers. 6,657. That's the number of people killed in El Salvador just last year. Remember that El Salvador has a smaller population than New York City, which only had 350 murders in all of last year. $750 million. That's how much money Congress just approved in aid to Central America. $16.2 billion. That's the number of dollars the U.S. spent on immigration, enforcement, and border control in 2014. And that is more than what was spent on the Drug Enforcement Agency, the FBI, and the Secret Service combined. And finally, 12, as in 12 years old. Children 12 and under are the fastest growing group of unaccompanied minors caught at the border. In 2014, that meant that 7,460 children under 12 were crossing the border. And that's certainly a number that tells a story. That's it for our program today. Latino USA is produced by Fernanda Chavarri, Marlon Bishop, Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music editor, and Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, I'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, and Carnegie Corporation, promoting the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
Stop the looting, stop the shooting. That one? Dun, 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 dun.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, ooh, that awkward moment when Siri just doesn't speak your language.
What do you want to say to Mom?
Mom, ¿cuándo vienes?
Your message to Mom says, Met I Love Units. Ready to send it?
That and other miscommunications next time on Latino USA.